Case number 18-3067, United States of America versus Eric Scurry, also known as E, appellant. Ms. Davis for the appellant, Mr. Lenners for the appellee.
You may start.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Mary Davis, and I represent the appellant, Eric Scurry. This case comes about as a result of Mr. Scurry's motion pursuant to 28 U.S.C. 2255, in which he argued his guilty plea was not knowing and voluntary because the evidence that was suppressed and Scurry won was evidence that induced his plea. The district court denied that motion, finding that Mr. Scurry must have been a target of the wiretap and that he was not a target. This circuit has not held whether targets of electronic surveillance have standing as an aggrieved person. The issue was raised in Glover, but since it was raised in the context of ineffective assistance of counsel, and because this court acknowledged that there's a split in the circuits, the issue was not decided because counsel could not be found ineffective for not raising something that was not clearly the law at the time. Appellant submits that this case presents the issue in such a light that makes it ripe for review. That is whether someone who was named as a target is an aggrieved person, and as a result thereof, any evidence that was suppressed could not be used against him in any proceeding.
Suppose you're right about that. There's still a substantial body of case law suggesting that a defendant need not know all the particulars about which evidence will or won't come in against the defendant at trial in order for the plea to be knowing. What do you do with all of those cases?
Well, I think in, Henderson v. Morgan states the plea may be involuntary because the defendant does not understand the nature of the constitutional protections he is waiving. In this case, Mr. Scurry waived his right to going to trial based on the representations by the government that he was going to be tried for the conspiracy, and that the conspiracy was the drugs that were sold as by all the other co-defendants against whom the government dismissed their cases. So I think that this is somewhat distinguishable from the situations where a defendant may not know what's coming in. A defendant never knows what's going to come in at trial, but when something...
This seems a little bit like that. Your theory is that the plea wasn't knowing because the defendant couldn't have predicted how a suppression motion would have turned out and therefore whether the evidence would have come in or not.
Well, that is true, but...
How is it different? We have just on one side of the line, what you do need to know are the nature of the charge, that's fine. The constitutional protections you get if you go to trial, right, not to testify, to confront witnesses, all of that, that's fine. Mm-hmm. All of the process that comes from criminal rule 11, and we have cases saying that's almost always going to be enough. And then on the other side of the line, there are these Supreme Court cases saying it's not enough just to have the defendant misunderstand the quality of the state's case, misunderstand the admissibility of evidence, specifically a coerced confession, not have access to impeachment evidence, and this feels a lot more like that latter line of cases.
But this court and Supreme Court has held that that a defendant must have noticed that is sufficient to give him an understanding of the law in relation to the facts of the case. Part of the law in this case ultimately was that all the evidence as a result of the wiretaps was suppressed. And I think this is distinguishable from the case where the where the defendant later brought up that his confession was illegally obtained. In that situation, the defendant knew that the confession was illegally obtained at the time that he pled guilty.
Davis, I'm not sure I even understand your theory of sort of what he didn't understand. At your brief at page 6 says, since the conversations could not be used against him in any proceeding, the guilty plea was not knowing and voluntary. On what ground would we conclude that they could not be used against him?
Because, and that is the main issue here, that it could not be used against him because we are arguing that he was a target. And as a target, the evidence could not be used against him. According to 2510 subsection 11, an aggrieved person is a person against whom the interception was directed. And directed, some cases have held that directed means a target. Mr. Scurry was named as a target. He was named as a potential person whose calls would be heard. And
when you say some cases have held that directed means a target, I'm not aware of any case that has held that an individual who was neither the possessor or owner or user of the phone, nor was one of the conversants on the phone, but just mentioned as someone about whom the government was seeking evidence, has ever successfully had their standing recognized to suppress wiretap evidence. Without any case that has so held, district court, court of appeals.
Right, but at the same time, as I noted in my brief at page 9 and 10, circuits have considered the target theory. And in Olivia, the court determined the defendant had standing because the affidavits included the investigators certifying their belief that the defendant's cell phone was at issue.
Yeah, the defendant's cell phone was at issue, and that's not the case here, right?
Well, right. But Mr. Scurry was listed in some of the wiretap applications as someone who was whose conversations maybe picked up, and he was listed as a target in the investigation.
But in fact, none of his is it accurate that none of his conversations were in fact picked up?
Conversations of his were picked up from on his own wiretap.
I'm talking about on the wiretaps.
Correct. Correct. They were not. And that is the point that the whole point of our argument, the whole premise is that he is still an aggrieved person because directed at, if you look at the language of the statute, directed at has to mean something. And I know the government cited a quotation from Jones, but Rackus basically said that the language from Jones against whom the search was directed, they basically said that, you know, to the extent that language may be read more broadly, it is dictum. My argument is that when Congress did this statute, when they wrote this statute, they did not put in extra words. It's not dictum. Directed at has to mean something. And if you look at the common definitions of directed, you see that it's a target. And Mr. Scurry was a target. And I think that the statute makes him an aggrieved person because directed at has to mean something. It's not just put in there for no reason. It means something. And directed at, as I noted in my brief, that directed at, if you look at the definitions of directed at and target, they're synonymous. And that's our argument.
The argument you're making was available to Mr. Scurry at the time that he entered his plea and known to counsel at that time. And indeed, there was a condition on the plea that defendants would be, including Mr. Scurry, would have an opportunity to withdraw if they maintained an opportunity to appeal the suppression issue, and if they prevailed, would have an opportunity to withdraw, which, as you know, happened to the other co-defendants. So it's a counsel problem, not a court problem, or is it that in this situation, the choice made by Mr. Scurry was to enter the plea with this condition, not a broader condition that would have allowed him to withdraw if the other defendants' wiretaps were suppressed?
I think the condition in Mr. Scurry's plea was that he could appeal. I did not do his direct appeal, but I understand
that at the plea stage.
Yeah, I did. And my understanding, looking back, is that the condition was that he could appeal the district court's decision on his motion to suppress.
When I first read it, I thought it was actually ambiguous on that point. It says, defendant may enter a conditional guilty plea, reserving his right to appeal the court's order of August 2012, denying defendants, plural, motions, plural, to suppress the wiretap evidence. But then it says specifically documents, confusingly it says documents, plural, 59 in this case, but document 59 is the order with respect to, or the his motion, I believe, only Mr. Scurry's motion. So I think you're right that the better reading is that he only reserved the right in the event that his own motion, which did not include these grounds, was granted. But what I'm saying is, if you think that Mr. Scurry had standing to suppress evidence resulting from the wiretaps of his co-defendants, then why didn't you counsel him to require that his condition in the plea so reflect, and why didn't counsel in moving to suppress move on Mr. Scurry's behalf to suppress the evidence coming from the other taps?
I believe at the time that when Mr. Scurry entered his plea, it was on the day of trial, and the government was quite strict on what they would allow the plea to be conditioned upon. I know that Mr. Scurry's, the amount of drugs that he was, that he pled guilty to, I believe it was higher than some of the other defendants in the case who pled earlier on. So there was, the government was not inclined to give Mr. Scurry a whole lot of benefit for his plea.
The amount of drugs that you're referencing was the amount from the full conspiracy, not his individual sales?
That's correct. Yes.
And I have just a procedural question for you, and that is, I think this whole thing started post-appeal when Mr. Scurry filed a motion to dismiss the indictment, and then I take it you came to him and said you could supplement, and I guess that's, and then you created the 2255. Is that how that happened?
That is how it happened, yes, because as you know, as Your Honor knows, ECF, I was getting notifications of what Mr. Scurry was filing and what the government was filing in response. And at that point in time, after discussions with Mr. Scurry, it was determined that filing a 2255 was the route.
So you saw what Mr. Scurry had done, and so you approached him.
Excuse me, Your Honor?
You saw what he had filed on your ECF, and that caused you to approach
him. Yes, yes.
You had been removed from his case, his direct appeal, because of a conflict of interest. That's why you didn't handle the direct appeal. He moved the district court to have you withdrawn as counsel because he was going to allege that you had been ineffective with respect to the plea. And so you were withdrawn on the direct appeal, correct?
Your Honor, I will believe you. I don't recall. I know Dennis Hart took over the appeal.
Yeah, that was the reason, a conflict of interest, conflict of interest. Did you discuss that conflict of interest with him when you went to assist him with his 2255 petition?
Yes, Your Honor. We had conversations.
Conversations? Do you have a written waiver of the conflict of interest?
No, I do not.
Did he actually make an informed waiver of the conflict of interest?
Well, Your Honor, Mr. Scurry never raised ineffective assistance of counsel.
That's not my question. My question is, you were aware that he had said he wanted to make an argument before his direct appeal that you had rendered ineffective assistance of counsel with respect to the plea, and then now you were coming in on your own initiative, as you just said, to assist his 2255. And you as counsel, of course, are responsible. He's not. You're responsible for obtaining a waiver.
Well, Your Honor, I will say that when Mr. Scurry entered his plea and was sentenced, I do not recall even now what the reason was that.
I don't have his filing. You'll have to trust me on that. I have his filing, and it was conflict of interest.
Okay, I believe you, but at the time when I... Right.
So it sounds like, in fact, that because time had elapsed and you didn't recall all these events, that we don't have a written waiver of this conflict of interest for Mr. Scurry before you came into the 2255 motion?
That's correct, but if your court would like me to obtain one from Mr. Scurry...
I don't think after the fact is going to be appropriate.
Well, then Mr. Scurry, of course, can request to file a successive 2255 based on that.
Well, those are really hard things to do. The question is, you know, the difficulty is that the nature of the claim you've raised here, as the Supreme Court has explained, and as my colleagues have explained, can't really be raised as a voluntariness, as the way you've teed it up. The way the claim you've presented here is supposed to be raised in a 2255 petition is through an ineffective assistance of counsel claim.
Well, I think
the court said as much, said directly in McMahon.
Right, and I think that McMahon is...
But you didn't raise it as an ineffective assistance of counsel claim.
Excuse me?
But you didn't raise it as an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, as the Supreme Court has said the type of argument you made should be packaged, because you would have had to argue your own ineffectiveness.
Well, that's true. Had I been aware.
It's like a bit of a conflict of interest.
It may be, but as
it
I said.
Maybe a conflict of interest, okay.
I don't think that there was a conflict of interest, because in all of my conversations and emails with Mr. Scurry, we discussed all different aspects of the 2255, and I'm not going to represent to the court a falsehood. Mr. Scurry never once suggested, nor did, that he wanted to raise ineffectiveness.
In your understanding of the rules of ethics, do you as an attorney informed about the rules of ethics, a member of the bar, an officer of the court, have an obligation when you have previously, when the defendant has previously said he wishes to raise an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, and then wishes to raise a claim on 2255 about his plea that, according to the Supreme Court, can only be presented as an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, and you are the plea counsel. Is your position that you had no obligation on your own to raise that conflict with him, discuss it, and obtain a formal written waiver?
As I said, I had many discussions with Mr. Scurry.
That's not the question I asked.
I thought Your Honor asked me, did I discuss it with him?
No, I'm asking you whether your obligation to raise that specific conflict, say the claim you want to present under Supreme Court precedent needs to be presented as an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, that would require me to argue against my own performance at the district court stage.
Well, Your Honor, was
that one of the conversations you had with him?
What the Supreme Court law was? No, I did not discuss that with him. But I would note that McMahon is distinguishable from the situation. In McMahon, the law was clear at the time of the plea. The law was clear that what the defendant was complaining about, I believe it was a coerced confession, that was known at the time of the plea. And I think, you know, look at, and so, and McMahon said that if the defendant thought his confession was involuntary and not usable against him at trial, it is unlikely he would have pled guilty. And later the court wrote, surely allegations that the confession rendered his plea involuntary would appear incredible. And so it was at that point, the defendant knew when he pled guilty that there was an illegal confession that could be or could not be used against.
I think we have your argument on the merits there. Okay, do my colleagues have any further questions?
No, thanks.
Okay, all right, we'll hear from the government now.
Good morning, and may it please the court, Dan Lenners for the United States. The defendant's attack on the knowing and voluntary nature of his guilty plea is foreclosed by a long line of Supreme Court precedent that makes clear that a guilty plea represents a break in the chain of events that preceded it that renders any prior constitutional or here statutory violations irrelevant, because the defendant has solemnly sworn under oath that he is factually guilty of the offense.
You would agree, though, that it could be, I'm sure you would dispute the merits of the claim, to be clear, but this type of claim under existing precedent could have been pressed, had it been pressed as an ineffective assistance of counsel claim.
Yes, Your Honor. That's what McMahon and Tollett and its progeny make clear, is that there are two ways in which such an attack could be made. One is as a Rule 11 violation, which the defendant has never alleged here, and the other is through ineffective assistance of counsel.
Yep, okay.
I'm happy to talk about target standing. I don't think the court need reach that issue here.
Can I clarify one thing? I just wanted to confirm with both parties. It seemed to me from the briefing and everything in the case, but I just wanted to confirm for the record that, like Mrs. Davis, you agree that his voice didn't show up on any of these wiretaps, even in momentary or fleeting, the other four wiretaps of the other four defendants.
So, Your Honor, I can't speak to the true facts of the wiretaps. I haven't listened to them. They occurred 10 years ago. He has never alleged that any of his conversations were intercepted on the Hudson wiretaps, which were the ones that said that they expected that he was a potential interceptee.
Did his trial counsel have access to hear I just don't know if the way these proceedings were going, were they ever turned over to him in a timely fashion so that his counsel could have listened to them all to determine if he was actually on any of these?
I assume that all of the wiretaps were turned over to counsel well in advance. Ms. Davis represented that Scurry pled guilty the day of trial. Certainly all of the wiretaps would have been turned over by then so that they—
You know, when in the process, I was not a criminal trial lawyer. Do you know when in the process are they usually turned over well in advance of trial?
I don't know. I assume so. There's substantive evidence that would be turned over so that the defendants can make an appropriate motion to suppress. So all of this is an assumption, Your Honor.
I haven't his motion to suppress. He did move to suppress his own wiretaps, but we don't know. We don't know if he'd had access to the other four defendants or not at the time of his filing of a motion to suppress, or if everybody just got their own wiretaps.
We don't know that, Your Honor. The defendants did move to join each other's motions. And the district court, in denying the motions to suppress the wiretaps, did have a section on standing in which it ruled basically in the government's favor and said that the defendants only had standing to challenge a wiretap that was on their phone or where one of their conversations was intercepted.
No, I understand that. I understand your argument on that front. That's exactly my question. I'm asking the factual question that's the predicate for that legal argument. And that is, does anybody actually know if his voice showed up on any of the four that they weren't all suppressed? I know two were, and then the government conceded at least as to a third, but we'll call it the four defendant wiretaps. So nobody, I mean, I'll have to ask counsel again on rebuttal, but the government doesn't know, at least at this point, whether he had access to all of the wiretaps of all four co-defendants.
Sitting here today, I don't know that, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, I appreciate it.
If the district court had ruled the way our court ruled, if it had in the first instance granted the suppression for the lack of the appropriate signature with respect to the four, I don't know if, I know you're an appellate lawyer, but do you have a sense of the logistics of how the government would have proceeded against Mr. Scurry on, for example, conspiracy charges? How do they get those, how do they get those wiretaps in? I mean, just, would they be hearsay? Typically they're being introduced against the defendant party.
Well, so to the degree that they were statements by a co-conspirator made in furtherance of the conspiracy, the government could introduce them under that hearsay exception as substantive evidence.
Only if you had independent evidence of the conspiracy, independent of the wiretaps, under our circuit precedent.
Correct. But, you know, there was ample evidence of Scurry's involvement in a conspiracy from his own, the wiretap on his own phone, which was not suppressed, which
really, is... The descriptions in your brief were just about him selling to his clients. Are there other, I didn't see descriptions in your brief of evidence of a conspiracy, and certainly not, again, from your brief, now maybe there's more there, I saw nothing to support the money laundering charge on his wiretap.
So as I recall, Your Honor, from the wiretap conversations, as well as the government's description of the case and its notice of intrinsic evidence, it was through the wiretap on Scurry's phone that the government learned that he was working with, I believe it was Robinson, one of the charged co-conspirators, as a street-level dealer at the second court location. And the
Robinson wasn't the one of the parties to the threat case, was it? Am I misremembering the names? But I thought it was different. I thought it was, all right, let me get there. It was Hudson and Johnson and Savoy and Brown. There was no Robinson. Were those the other four?
On whose phone there was a wiretap, but Robinson was a co-conspirator, Your Honor. So, in the government supplemental
appendix. Oh, so whatever happened to his case? He was in this case? I haven't seen reference to him in this case. Okay. I'm sorry, that's my
mistake. So there's an individual named Nathan Robinson who was charged as one of the six defendants.
Okay.
The government's notice of extrinsic evidence, which is in our supplemental appendix, talks about how Scurry redistributed crack in this second court area, that Robinson also did that, and that those two would work together.
Oh, but that wouldn't be a basis for getting in wiretaps on four different people.
Well, that would establish, Your Honor asked about independently.
Robinson, it would be evidence, I won't say establish, it would be evidence of a conspiracy with Robinson. That doesn't connect him to Hudson, Johnson, Scurry, Brown.
But then I think the point of investigating Hudson was to figure out who Scurry was obtaining his crack from. And so that would have been all additional evidence of this larger conspiracy that allowed the government to work up the chain. But regardless, as we pointed out in our brief, the government had ample evidence of Scurry's own distribution of more than 200.
His own distribution. You outlined that pretty thoroughly in your brief, but that's not conspiracy and that's not money laundering, which were the two charges to which he pled.
So the money laundering, I just having reviewed the plea agreement briefly, involved him using his crack proceeds to buy a car and other things, which wouldn't have depended on wiretap evidence at all. And the as I said, the conspiracy charge started with him and Robinson working together, and the notice of extrinsic evidence expressly states that. And so that would be a conspiracy, as would, the typical chain narcotics conspiracy, which is you conspire with the people above you in the chain, even if you don't know who they are, because you know that the drugs that you're selling must be coming from somewhere.
So the So the four wiretaps that were suppressed as to their, as the people who were in possession of the phones, would have come in to a case, a Scurry case, as statements by co-conspirators, and the conspiracy, the threshold conspiracy evidence that would open the door to that is evidence from Mr. Scurry's wiretap that he was working together with Robinson. And that becomes evidence of a conspiracy. And then unnamed people up the chain, otherwise hearsay evidence among and between them comes in based on that predicate?
I believe the Scurry wiretap established that he was obtaining crack from Hudson, which is why the government was able to get a wiretap on Hudson's phone. He was the first person after Scurry, so the government was moving up the line. And Your Honor, the court's asking a lot of questions that I'm not really prepared to answer because the disposition of this case seems so clear. But I believe it's likely that the Scurry wiretap established sufficient evidence of his distributor or his supplier for the government to then move up to Hudson. And that was that was one of the flawed wiretaps, which is what rendered everything thereafter problematic. But this was the government's attempt to work its way up to the highest level supplier. And so I believe that there was likely sufficient evidence of Scurry in a larger conspiracy from his own phone, which is what established the connection with Hudson, which is what allowed the government to get the wiretap on Hudson. And that evidence would have been put forth in the affidavit in support of a search warrant for Hudson's phone, which is in the defendant's appendix.
Right. That's really helpful.
The court has no further questions. We'd ask that the judgment of the district court be affirmed.
You have any more questions?
No.
Thank you very much, Mr. Leonards. All right, Ms. Davis, you didn't have any time left, but we'll give you a minute. And I'm sorry, 2 minutes. I apologize. Okay.
Thank you.
Before you start, I would like you to answer this question for me. Can you advise me as to whether you, as plea counsel, had access to and listened to all of the wiretaps from the other four defendants? And you heard, when you told me you didn't recall him being on those, that you can tell me that he was not on those, or it's something that's really not known?
Your Honor, I was not appointed counsel in this case. Christopher Davis was. The reason I ended up doing the plea on that particular day is because Mr. Davis was in another trial, I believe, and he came in later that day. And I believe Mr. Davis did the sentencing. So it would have been Mr. Davis who listened to everything. I'm certain, though, that he would. I believe, Your Honor, I can't say whether everything was given. Yeah, if everything was given to each counsel.
Can you tell me whether Hudson's name, whether there was evidence on the wiretaps of Mr. Scurry's phone, evidencing that he obtained drugs from Mr. Hudson?
Yes. And because that is how, from Mr. Scurry's wiretaps, that's how they were able to get
What was the, do you know what it was?
Your Honor, I don't know, Your Honor. I would know, make a couple of corrections here, is that Scurry 1 suppressed only the wiretap evidence for Hudson and Johnson. It did not go to the other defendants. When the case was sent back down to the district court, the government made the choice to dismiss the cases against all of the defendants other than Mr. Scurry. So I would note that is one correction to the record here. And the other point I would like to make is that if there was other evidence of a conspiracy, as the government states, then they wouldn't have dismissed the cases against all the defendants. The wiretaps were the evidence, and so there's nothing else. And my final point is that This issue could not have been raised in the terms of ineffective assistance of counsel, because that that is what happened in Glover, and the issue was not decided.
Okay. My colleagues have any further questions? No. All right, thank you. The case is submitted.